at least.
Or are there any cities then that the Reds players like to go in and play, say Philadelphia or somewhere like that?
I think they like Philadelphia. Philadelphia has a record of booing everything. They tell us there's a speaker, Bob Uecker, ex-catcher. He's really funny. He said they boo everything. He said if they have an Easter egg on, he said they boo the kids that don't find the Easter eggs. And if there's three of them standing on a corner waiting for a red light, if the red light doesn't, the green light doesn't come on, pretty soon they start booing one another on the corner. But it's just enthusiasm. Philadelphia's a real good sports town, and the players like to go there. Umpires do not. They thought it was the worst because the police force wouldn't help them at all. If they get in trouble, the police would run, they'd hide, so they wouldn't have to expose themselves to boos from the crowd by protecting the umpire. But Philadelphia, the ballpark, the new ballpark, the ballplayers like it because it's a good ballpark to hit in. And it's wonderful dressing quarters and all that, and just like they like Cincinnati, I think most ball clubs like to come into Cincinnati.
Now, when you had your ball club in 39-40, did Philadelphia react the same way? Were there other towns that the Reds would rather play in because they liked the town or they liked the fans? Not necessarily whether they liked the ballpark. I know some ballparks are better to hit in and play in, but were there towns that they looked forward to going into, maybe because of the restaurants or the entertainment that the towns offered or the fans?
I think the ball players for cities like Chicago and New York, they could have their choice of a wide variety of places to go, restaurants and all sorts of movies or shows, whatever they wanted. I think they liked New York and Chicago, and I think they disliked Philadelphia, dead blue law town, and Boston I think they liked because the good seafood up there. They had different reasons for it. Most of them, their likes and dislikes were governed by whether they liked to play in a ballpark or not. But other things being nearly equal, they liked the larger cities.
How about St. Louis? Well, what did that offer?
St. Louis wasn't too appealing to the players themselves. It was so hot there normally in the summertime, I didn't ever hear them say, really. My observation wouldn't permit me to say they liked it or disliked it, but I'm just assuming that they didn't like it too well.
Did that hold true for the same about Pittsburgh?
Pittsburgh was much like Philadelphia. They didn't like Pittsburgh.
Now, let me ask you this question, and then you explain it on tape, and to make sure that the clarification is there. Now, if I understand it correctly, Hershberger did claim exemption because his mother was in need of his financial help, and he did channel this help to her in different ways without her knowing it. However, she claimed that she was independent, that she did not need this, and therefore this is one of the things that he brooded about. Now, this is what I would like to have clarified. Is it the fact that he felt that he did not go to the service, that he had let his country down, that his manhood had been challenged because of this? Or was it the fact that he felt that he had declared dependency for a mother that didn't actually need it?
I don't think there was any doubt in his mind about his feeling, and rightfully so, that his mother was genuinely dependent upon him. But he didn't want to hurt his mother's pride by making that known. And he was afraid, really, of his mother's feelings if she knew he was claiming her as a dependent, if it would hurt her pride. And he was torn between emotions, and she was dependent upon him. Anyone who knew the situation knew that she was, and he would channel money to her in under the rug, under the table. And he just got to thinking maybe that he wasn't doing right by claiming his mother as a dependent. And he got to questioning it in his own mind. It was never questioned by anybody else, and I'm sure they investigate those things. And I just think it was a question of not a guilty conscience, but his just wondering. And then when other things, he was an emotional kid, and when other things would happen, when he would strike out in a pinch or something of that kind, he'd his favorite expression many times, well, I'm no good. I'm no good. When he'd strike out, for example, or when he caught the ball, I don't think the ball that was hit, except that it added fuel to the fire, his already stirring up inside him, that had anything more to do with it than maybe if he struck out 2 days before that. I think it just, he was so constituted that he was a very conscientious, fine young man.
Mr. Giles, 39 and 40 teams were your ball clubs. You built them. They belong to you. What do you think the public should know? What do you think that the ball clubs should have the public know? What are the things that you would like to see in an article about those type of teams, the 39 to 40 teams? What do you think belongs to the public in an article about those teams?
Well, I don't know exactly what you mean.
Well, what I mean is the points that really should be brought out that possibly I haven't touched on here that would be of interest to people, that would be of value to them in the game and the nostalgia of the game.
Well, I really don't know. It was Bill McKechnie's handling of the team was masterpiece, I think. He stayed aloof from the players, and they wanted to be close to him, and he was close to them, but they didn't know it. He's a mystery manager. I just told some minute ago, this UPI man asked about Walter Alston. I said he's just like, much like McKechnie. McKechnie wouldn't be the kind that would stir a ball club up. But his idea was that the contest and the pride that they had in their own game was enough to stir them up. If it wasn't money, certainly their pride. And pride came before money. And he thought that everybody wanted to stay on the ball club and that they would put out. Therefore, he paid no attention to stirring them up at all. He tried to keep some of them calm, who were inclined to get a little excited. I remember one deal that we made for Walters, which was one of the big deals that helped us, I think, was we had just earlier that year, at the tail end of the year before, we got Virgil Davis from the Cardinals for $15,000. And when we wanted Walters from Philadelphia, they needed money, and they wanted $55,000 and Davis. So that was a lot of money in those days. So I went to Mr. Crosley and told him, and he'd never been talked to in terms of that kind. I said, we want to get Walters from Philadelphia, and they want $55,000 and Davis. And he said, oh my, And he said, is he that good? And I said, well, Bill McKechnie and I both think that he is, and we want him. He said, but we just paid $15,000 for Davis. That's $70,000, Warren. And I said, yes, it is when you look at it that way, but Davis doesn't mean anything to us. And we have Hirschberger and we have Lombardi, and he just, Davis doesn't mean a thing to us. And he said, well, if you and, he said, try and get him cheaper if you can. I said, well, we've nubbed it down. We've negotiated this thing down to rock bottom, I'm sure. And if we don't make that deal, I don't think we can make any deal. So he said, well, do you think we can get any of it back by his joining our ball club? And I said, well, it's problematical. You don't know. And we think he'll help us win. And as we win, we'll draw more people. We draw more people, we'll take in more money. And so finally he said, well, if you and Bill are really agreed on, he said, let me talk to Bill. So he got Bill McKechnie on the phone, and he said, yes, I want him badly. So that was a big deal for us. It was the turning point, I think. And the ball club itself was, really, it wasn't a closely knit ball club at all. It Bill kept them together, but there weren't any four or five or three or four that ran together. It was almost a team of individuals. But on the ball field, from the time the ball game started, and on the bench and in the clubhouse, they were one big family. But more so in the clubhouse and on the field and on the bench, I think. But after the game was over, you'd rarely see more than two of them together. It was a little unusual that way.
Now, you mentioned the last time we talked about picnics that you had for the team. Was this unusual in the big leagues? Did other organizations have a close family thing like that? I was rather impressed when you mentioned that there were picnics that the ball club would come to. Did this show more camaraderie than some of the other teams might have?
Yes, a little bit. I think I encouraged that all I could. And there would be social functions that the ball teams would go to, and that many players, not all of them. Lombardi didn't. He just was a loner, we say. He didn't go. But it was an unusual team, really it was. It's hard to describe it. I didn't think anything about it at the time, but since you mentioned it, it just was unusual. And I think Bill McKechnie was a master at keeping them together without having old meetings and too many meetings and all that kind. He just, he was a master.
Well, there wasn't animosity one for the other one or anything like that. It was just the fact that they were all individualistic. Is that right?
They just didn't socialize. I tell you, we had a little... There's jealousy among wives, players' wives, and it got to a point where we had a box for the players' wives, tickets, where they'd sit. Finally, Gabe Paul and I talked this thing over, and he'd heard things, and I'd heard things, and the usher had heard things down there, that we just kind of separated the wives. Didn't put them all together. Just put three or four one place, three or four another place, and scatter them around a little bit. Because the players' wives are... Well, there's jealousy there because one ball player will be getting more money than the other, and, well, the ball players will never say a word about it. The players' wives will if somebody comes out with a blue fox fur on and the other one just comes out in a wash dress, where they just begin to look around, wonder, well, then they want to say, well, I'm going to get a fox fur too. And so we, with all those things, there was a feeling among the wives, I didn't have any concrete evidence of it, but Gabe had heard it, and our ushers would tell us, and we could sense it. Because when we did divide them up, split them up a little bit, we didn't hear so much. And we were afraid that if the ball player or the player's wives got to arguing among themselves, or there was jealousy or a feeling between the wives, there would be a feeling between the players. But I didn't ever notice that, but there were no groups. And they would be together off the field only when you'd get them together, really.
Have you, down through the years, noticed any other ball clubs that were able to win pennants that were that individualistic, that did not go at least in two or three groups? Have you ever noticed teams that it has hurt, where they might have won pennants had it been closer together? So it's really a two-part question. Have there been other teams as individualistic as the 1939 and 40 Reds that have won pennants, and have there been ball clubs that may have won it had they not been so individualistic?
I don't know of any. I know of clubs that have won a lot of ball games that had players that didn't speak to each other on the field. And I don't think that makes too much difference. You'll find the news media sometimes, if a team begins to lose and the player will say something, not jokingly, but not in a derogatory manner, about some other player, well, that's the third time that he's had a chance to win or to hit in the winning run. He hasn't done it. Now, some of the enterprising reporters will say there's dissension on the ball club. So-and-so is criticizing so-and-so for not hitting in the run. But they seem to win. I don't think camaraderie is too essential. I think if you're a manager, if you have cliques and individuals that your manager can't handle, then you're in trouble. But if your manager can keep them together during nine innings of a ball game, that's his job.
Mr. Giles, what's the difference, really, in the tenement fan, and that's exactly about what it was in Brooklyn and Yankee Stadium in the Bronx, the tenement fan that filled those ballparks and the fans that filled the Cincinnati ballparks? You think that fan is more romantic than what we'll write about in the Cincinnati fans? I know a lot of the authors have made this a big issue, the romanticism of the tenements and the subways to Yankee Stadium and to Brooklyn's Ebbets Field, where Cincinnati, you drove your automobile or rode a streetcar to Crosley Field. What's your thinking?
Well, I haven't noticed any difference, really, and I think to get back to what we were talking about earlier, the homespun, the country atmosphere, the small-town boy, I think that comes more from the fan, the fan's feeling of country is more pronounced in a city like Cincinnati, where they come from 100 miles, 75 miles or more, and they come into Cincinnati. I think the best example I know is that in Philadelphia, for example, take that for example, and New York, those two I can think of particularly, on a Labor Day, the fan there will go to the beach. We'll take the three-day holiday, the Saturday, Sunday, and the Monday. And their attendance on Sundays, Sunday preceding Labor Day, will be one of the low Sundays of the season. Whereas a city like St. Louis and Cincinnati, the Sunday preceding Labor Day will be a big Sunday because people come in from the hinterlands and make it a three-day holiday in the city from the country. They come from the country into the city. And it's noticeable in the Sunday attendance. I don't know what the statistics are right now, but I'm sure that since they made the holiday on Monday, most of these holidays now, that the larger cities are hurt a little bit by the Sunday preceding the holiday, whereas St. Louis and Cincinnati might be helped.
You know, there was a book written not so long ago, The Glory Years, and they had Ruth, Cobb, a lot of the other greats, the all-time greats on the cover. Do you think that we could write something in 1970 and 1974 and call it the Glory Years? Or do you think that when the old stadiums were torn down and television took over, like the other week right here in Cincinnati, when the game was scheduled on a Saturday night, they moved it to a Saturday afternoon in order to complement television. Do you think that the fan has become over-sophisticated today because of television, and those glory years are gone when we really knew baseball for what it really was?
No, I'd say you could call these the glory days. It depends upon what you attach glory to. Performance, artistic performance, is better today than it was. There's more technology employed in a ball game. They have five coaches now, or they used to have two. They have a hitting instructor, they have a pitching instructor. They take movies of every game, and a player will go in and study it. In that way, it is so much better than it was in the olden days. The difference is that the players were more rugged in those days. I think the pitcher would go nine innings longer. I think not that he behaved himself or took care of himself any better. I can remember in spring training years ago, the players would have to go to hot springs for a week or two to take off a big belly. Now they're reported in good shape. I'd say if you attach glamour and money, if you think that's glorious, then these are more glorious days than the old days were. It depends on what you mean glory. I think the we talk about the good old days. Well, they were good old days, but these are really glory days now, I think, with the attendance and television, radio, you have experts. I think the television and radio is a great thing for the shut-ins. It's a terrific thing. You read of ball players getting letters from people who haven't seen a ball game. Haven't seen it. They've heard it on the radio or seen it on television. They haven't been able to get to the ball game. And I think that has created, I think there are more people who know baseball now because of the television and radio than ever before.
That brings me to another question. What does a radio or a TV announcer really do for a ball club? What does he really do for a franchise? Can he help it? Can he hurt it? Or does he just sort of keep a status quo? And just how are these men selected? When you were there in 39 and 40 with the Reds, was it your decision? Was it the sponsor's decision? Or was it a combined decision? Like the sponsor you was mentioning the last time we talked about Eyebold Cigars, say they wanted Dick Baker. Was it Roger Baker? Supposing they wanted Roger Baker, he sounded good to them, they signed him to a contract, or did you sign him, or did you okay a contract they had signed him to?
The procedure, and it's still in vogue now, I think, was that the sponsor would hire the announcer and pay him, partially because we didn't want the sponsor, the announcer, on our payroll. Didn't want people to say, well, he's an employee of the ball club, you must expose. No wonder he says nice things. Mm-hmm. Just like we wouldn't want a newspaper man on the payroll of a ball club. And so, but we had the veto power that they would submit names. And we would have the veto power of saying, well, we don't want this announcer. We'd know something about him, maybe they didn't know. Mm-hmm. Voice or his enthusiasm or whatever it was. And then before that, would they would have 2 and 3 year contracts. And they wouldn't contract with the announcer longer than we would contract with them for the rights. Therefore, it would give us the veto power after 2 or 3 years, whatever the contract was, if we didn't like the, if they wanted to continue the announcer, we had the veto power. I don't know of any time, really, that the club has actually vetoed a ball player, an announcer, because what was objectionable to the club probably became objectionable to the sponsor, too. He would get the complaints. I think the announcer that stimulates the crowd but has a change of pace, that everything is not a Pollyanna, I think he's the effective announcer. He has to show enthusiasm. Some fans like different types of announcing. Some fans like to hear what's going on in the ballpark, ball game. I like to hear he struck out, he singled the right field. I just like a report. But I'm a baseball man. I don't care for all this folly row. And with television now, it has reduced the radio announcers' enthusiasm sometimes, because before they had television, every catch was a great catch. Yay! Just wonderful. Marvelous. You see it on TV now, it's the routine catch. They can't say that. So I think announcers are, they appeal to different fans, because I've had that. Now, Wade Hoyt was a fine announcer, but Wade Hoyt was a critic. And while I like to listen to him, I can remember one incident, the only time that I really was critical of Hoyt, and I was really upset about it. Blackwell was pitching, and we were playing St. Louis, and Blackwell struck Musial out the second time, and in the same inning, eighth inning, he struck out Shane Deist. And Wade Hoyt, I happened to be driving in from someplace, and I heard it on the radio during the ball game. And he said, well, I've never seen Shane Deist look worse at bat. Musial, I understand, did have a cold yesterday and had a little temperature last night. Well, that's the second time he struck out Musial. Well, it burned me up, because he should have been an announcer for the Reds. He should have talked about the fine pitching of Blackwell, not say that, well, maybe what he's saying, and I told him later, what you're saying, well, maybe Blackwell struck him out because he's sick. And, well, he said he did have a cold. I said, wait, just remember this. I said, you're a good announcer, and just tell what goes on. Don't say when a fellow makes an error that it's an excusable error. It's just a boo-boo. That's what it is. That's all right if he doesn't. But you must remember that the people that you are broadcasting to, 90% of them are Cincinnati fans, or they wouldn't be listening. And people like to hear good things about their team rather than bad things. So they would have enjoyed your being enthusiastic about Blackwell's great pitching, rather than the fact that Musial had a temperature the night before. And that's the only time, but he was that kind of announcer, a good announcer. And he had a good change of pace. People had confidence in what he said. Mm-hmm. And now they have an announcer in Oakland now. Was it White Sox? And he was at St. Louis, Harry Carey. Terrifically. He was my pen pal. He'd give the umpires a devil, and I'd write him about it. I'd hear it. He'd excite people. He'd really get them furious. He'd stimulate letters to me. I know that. He'd talk about it. He says, well, that's another one of those Giles umpires. And then I'd get letters. Mm-hmm. But he had people stirred up. He really did. Vince Scully at the Dodgers recites the ball game. Tells you what's going on and tells you the background. He's a great announcer, I think. I thought Al Michaels, who they just had here, was a fine announcer. Matter of fact, he said that he patterned himself after Vince Scully, he'd tape games that Scully would do, and then he'd play them over and over and over and over and listen to them.
He was a strict fundamentalist.
Yes.
He gave you the play.
That's right. Now, Marty Brenneman, who's here, is a very enthusiastic and gives you a good description of a ball game, but it's a little bit more enthusiastic than Al Michaels was. I like him very much. And he has a good balance wheel in homespun Joe Nuxall. Mm-hmm. Well, as he wind it up, Marty has a way of winding up the ball game, and this one belongs to the Reds. Mm-hmm. And Nuxall will say, well, good night, everyone. Here's your old left-hander rounding third and heading for home. Mm-hmm. And it's a good balance, really it is. He's a homey country boy announcer.
Would you think Hoyt, even though he was a critic, was more of a, with Burger Beer especially, was more of a homey type, really, than somebody coming out of a Brooklyn high school and playing with the Yankees all his life, although he never let you forget it. But don't you think he had a rapport with the Cincinnati people along the same line?
He had a great rapport. They thought he was great. But Hoyt really made his reputation. Not his reputation, but really endeared himself to people by his monologue when it was rain, when there'd be a rain delay.
Yeah.
And he'd laugh, and he'd tell stories. He had an infectious laugh, just contagious. He'd people to laugh, and he'd laugh. He'd tell these stories about the Yankees.
A sincere type.
Really sincere. Yeah. Really, really fine person, fine announcer, and a little different than Brenneman, for example. And
he didn't have the finesse or the real flair.
No, he wasn't excitable at all.
No,
nothing at all. He'd say, well, that was really a great play. I don't know.